This is Fresh Air. The new frontier is electronic communications, and everyone wants in on the action. Last week, the phone company Bell Atlantic and the cable company Telecommunications Inc. announced plans to merge. They're hoping to be key players in the creation of the information superhighway that would interconnect video, phones, and computers. My guest Howard Rheingold is the author of a new book about computer networks called Virtual Community. He's worried that mega corporations will try to commercialize and control those computer communities. A lot of his book is about the Internet, the network of computer networks that connects people around the world. They share information, expertise, opinions, and gossip through their computers. To understand the implications of the planned merger, you need to know something about the new technology.
When you connect a computer to the telephone network, and that's what a computer bulletin board system is. It's an affordable computer that you plug into your telephone with a device known as a modem. You create, in essence, a new medium, and that medium has characteristics that other communication media have not had. One of them is that it enables people to connect with each other in new ways. That's what I mean by virtual communities. You can connect with people who may be in another part of the world, who you may not know, but you share an interest with them. And there's a great power that comes from that. The second characteristic that's important is that it's a many-to-many medium. Instead of a broadcast medium where you either need a lot of money to buy airtime or you need paratroopers to capture the broadcast station, this is an instance in which every citizen can be a publisher, every citizen can be an eyewitness or a broadcaster, simply because every node on the network can broadcast to every other node.
And this kind of computer communication, the computer bulletin boards, is already going on in a very, very democratic way on something called the Internet. Would you describe what the Internet is?
All right. The Internet was really funded by taxpayers' money about 20 years ago for Defense Department researchers to connect computers remotely. Now, it turned out that there was a happy side effect. Besides being able to operate different computers at a distance by connecting them over communication lines, people were able to type messages to each other and store those messages in electronic mailboxes. And it turned out that those programmers who were building the network wanted to communicate with each other a lot. That proved to be so useful that other researchers, other scientists, business people, students, educators, citizens demanded access to that, to the degree that we now have somewhere between 10 and 20 million people on the Internet exchanging electronic mail, sending files back and forth, conducting debates, building communities. It's really exploded from the grassroots. This is nothing that was planned to be a mass medium.
You describe the Internet as the largest functioning anarchy in the world. In what sense is it anarchic?
Well, there's nobody who tells you whether you can have a forum or not. There's no central control to it, really. People choose which areas they subscribe to and which areas they send their information out to. It's radically decentralized. You know, when I talked about broadcast media, the first thing that happens in a political coup is you try to capture the television station. Well, you can't really capture the Internet station because it's every node along the line. You have to eliminate either the entire communications infrastructure of a country, or you have to go house to house and take every computer. And we saw that during Tiananmen Square and the political upheaval in the Soviet Union, that a lot of information got out that would not have otherwise got out because it is so decentralized.
Now, last week, there was a merger between Bell Atlantic, a phone company, and Telecommunications Incorporated, a cable giant. This is the biggest media merger in history. And the CEO of Telecommunications Inc. said, "This will allow us to control all the communication needs of a household with one device." What's the device?
The device, they hope, will be a set-top box that will be an adjunct to the television set that will control the video coming in and maybe coming out, that will control all of the communications that perhaps are happening on the Internet now. I think that that's a very frightening idea, and that we as citizens, whether we are interested in technology or not, need to understand that communication is really at the basis of democracy, and that control of the means by which citizens communicate with each other is a political act.
Well, what are your fears of big industry getting more into the act?
Well, I think a good example of what has happened in the past is the personal computer industry happened because the big boys in the computer industry were looking the other way. Steve Wozniak, when he invented the Apple I, tried to sell it to Hewlett-Packard, and Hewlett-Packard wasn't interested. So these kids in their garages created a technology that gives a lot of power to citizens. They created an industry, which is now a very large one. I believe that Microsoft is bigger than General Motors. The big boys are not looking the other way now. Will they be able to use their power and their size and their money to restrain the Steve Jobses and Steve Wozniaks and Bill Gates of the future from starting new industries, from showing us new things we can do with this technology? Or is it going to be the same old thing?
My guest is Howard Rheingold, author of the new book Virtual Community. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. My guest, Howard Rheingold, is the author of a new book about computer networks called The Virtual Community. Your new book, Virtual Community, is about different computer networks that have sprung up here and around the world. The first computer network that you signed onto is called The Well. Why don't you describe what The Well is?
Well, The Well is the Whole Earth Electronic Link. It was started by the same people who started the Whole Earth Catalog and the Whole Earth Review, and it was meant to bring this computer conferencing medium that the elites have had access to ordinary people like you and I. It's not just for computer nerds, and I'm a writer. I'm interested in computers because they help me do that. I'm not an engineer. I connected with this service because I could do it for $2 an hour and quickly found out that it really wasn't about technology. It was about people. It was about finding somebody to help me when I found a tick on my daughter's head.
Yeah, why don't you tell that story?
Well, you know, when you're in the other room, typing on a computer and communicating with someone who's not there, then the person you live with gets a little curious about what's going on and can cause a strain in that relationship. The night my wife really understood what was happening with The Well was when we found a tick on our baby's head in the middle of the night. And fortunately, that's a kind of minor thing, but to young parents, that's a crisis. She called the pediatrician. I logged on to The Well. By the time we got the call back from the pediatrician, I had received instructions from a doctor on The Well who told me what to do with the tick. Now, the light bulb went on in my wife's head. She realized, oh, those people out there, they're not only having fun, but they're helping each other. And that was illustrated in a much more poignant manner a few months later, when one of the people who participated in the parenting conference on The Well, place where we talk about our kids, revealed that his son had been diagnosed with leukemia. Within minutes, there was a task force organized of people to support that friend, not only with the kind of emotional support that another parent can give you, but kind of information that a pediatric oncology nurse and a couple of doctors and a couple of people who have had blood disorders had to offer. That kind of reaching out to people in the real world, that kind of help to people, has nothing to do with technology, has everything to do with community, and that's what I want to see remain alive. They can have their 500 channels, they can have their video on demand. Let's leave a green belt so citizens can help each other and build communities.
You've been logging on to networks since the mid-80s, and in that time, a lot of other people have logged on, too. And I wonder if you've seen changes because of that, if it's, as it becomes more popular, as more and more people are participating, is the nature of the conversation changing?
Yes. Well, you know, when I started on The Well, it was about 500 people about 8 years ago, and it's about 9,000 people now. It's like you live in a town of 500 people. You see everybody every day. You know most of the people. You leave your doors unlocked. When a town of 500 grows to a town of 9,000, you don't know everybody. You don't trust everybody. You don't leave your doors unlocked. So that effect has happened worldwide. Norms, the way people elaborate rules among themselves rather than rules that are given to them by some authority, that takes time to emerge, and the population online is growing faster than the norms are emerging. So there is conflict on the net. This is not a utopia. People can get into quite violent, although only verbally violent, disagreements with one another. So we're seeing a lot of turmoil in the culture as it is expanding. I think that that turmoil is ultimately very rich, and that it is from debate and from having contact with people you don't agree with that understanding and democracy emerges.
Well, you're saying, you know, now that the town isn't just a town of 500 anymore, you can't leave the doors unlocked. What kind of bad things can happen when the population grows?
The medium itself has certain characteristics that are both good and bad, depending on how you use it. The fact that you don't know the race or age or nationality or physical appearance of the people you're communicating with, that erases a lot of barriers that usually tend to separate people. People communicate with each other in ways that they didn't communicate with each other before, and they communicate with people that they wouldn't have communicated with before. That grandma who wouldn't even make eye contact with those teenage boys who are hanging out downstairs from where she lives might have a lively discussion with them as soon as she gets into her apartment. That same characteristic, however, masks a lot of human communication. The kind of nuances on communication that you get from tone of voice, facial expression, body language, those are also absent, and therefore miscommunications can occur and people can deceive each other. We had this case on The Well where there was an online Casanova who turned out to be romancing three separate women at a distance, and none of them knew about each other until they started comparing notes. It's easy to deceive people. I think we need to learn that just because you may share intimate facts of your life by typing on a computer with some stranger, that you don't necessarily want to trust that stranger with certain aspects of your life.
Have you been deceived?
Have I been deceived? Sure. Have I been cheated out of anything? Not really. I think that you have to distinguish between a medium that enables you to make connections with people and the kinds of relationships that follow from those connections. Once you have found someone who shares an interest with you, you really can't develop a true, deep friendship unless you share something in real life, the place where your body is. Unless you meet that person, you learn what it's like to be with them, you have some kind of shared experience with them, that's not really the kind of foundation for friendship and trust that I would like to have in my life.
Now, I want you to know that the last time I interviewed you, and this was about virtual reality, a few people logged on to their computers, and I think this was in The Well, to say that, unfortunately, my interview with you was just another generic interview about virtual reality. So my questioning of you the last time around did not get good reviews on the internet. So we'll see if there's any response this time.
But another characteristic of this medium is that it's a dissent amplifier.
Yes, that's right.
A few bad reviews by people who are outspoken may have a disproportionate effect. There may have been hundreds of people who thought it was great. And in fact, this program reaches more of the people that I normally communicate with than any other medium. I've been on all three networks and on primetime television. I've been in the major news magazines. All I ever hear is, gee, I heard you on Fresh Air last week. There's a tremendous reach here.
Well, we'll see what the people on the internet have to say about that.
Right. Well, we will know this afternoon. People are going to be talking about it on the internet. And, you know, it's another channel to the news. When something big happens in the world now, the regime at our house is you turn on CNN and you log on to The Well. During Tiananmen Square, during the Soviet coup, during the Gulf War, I had access to people giving eyewitness reports. In fact, during the events in Moscow a couple of weeks ago, I logged on to The Well, and there was email that was being posted because someone's daughter was in Moscow looking out her window, describing what she was seeing that CNN was not seeing. She was transmitting that from Moscow to her father via the internet. He was posting it for us all to see. I think increasingly we will see that citizens are going to be eyewitnesses and sources of news information And misinformation.
That's it, Howard. I want to stop you right there. Misinformation. We only have a few seconds here, but how do you know who to trust? If you don't really know the person and somebody's logging on and they're describing something, how do you know it's accurate? If a doctor's giving you an information, how do you know they're a real doctor?
We have access to a lot of information from a lot of people now. We also have access to a lot of misinformation. We are going to have to develop some kind of community means of determining who you can trust and who you can't trust. And I think in any community, you can ask people. I knew that that doctor who gave me advice was a real doctor and knew what he was talking about because I had interacted with him before and because several people I trust told me to trust him.
Howard Rheingold is the author of the new book, The Virtual Community. This is Fresh Air.